Josh is going to talk to us today about a particular example of market risk management. For his sins, Josh is part of the global leadership team for Milliman, responsible for sorting this risk management activity and hedging over US $500 billion worth of assets. That's Josh's formal bio. His informal bio is in the latest Actuary Australia, if anyone is interested, where you can read that one of his interesting or quirky hobbies is playing 500, so we might see you over at the casino later on tonight, Josh. Well. Over to you for about 25 minutes, and then we'll take questions.
Thanks very much, Bernard. Welcome, everyone. I'm Josh Corrigan. So what I'm going to be talking to you today is about currently my experiences at one of the biggest projects Milliman has actually conducted in its history. And hopefully I'll give you a little bit of insight into the business aspects, the operational aspects, the systems aspects, and the risk management and capital aspects of a very, very large implementation by a pretty significant company in the UK called Phoenix Group. So I'll give you a little bit of background on who the company are, what the key drivers of their move towards essentially a new paradigm in the operational capability of, I think, of an insurance company. I'll run you through relatively quickly some example output and talk through some of the design and operational dimensions of what they're trying to do, what they have done, before wrapping up with some of the challenges. So hopefully I'll take around about 25 minutes, which would give us 10-15 minutes of discussion. So to give you a little bit of background, for those of you, maybe just to raise a hand, has anyone heard of Phoenix Group? Excellent, okay, about half. So for those of you who aren't aware, Phoenix Group is one of the biggest insurance companies in the UK. They're probably about fourth biggest in terms of assets under management. Essentially, their business model is to buy up closed books of business. So they're not open to new business at all. And amongst their 6 million policyholders, they have a range of policyholders that have come from literally 40, 50-plus individual books that they've aggregated through one form or another, including some of the books of some of the Australian insurers who used to operate in that country. So they're a very, very large company. They employ probably about over 200 actuaries. And essentially, they have a suite of products on their books that covers pretty much every type of product that's ever been written in the UK over the last 30 years. So literally, they cover a whole range of collective investment, unit-linked, investment-linked type of products, almost every form of guarantee that has been seen in the UK, they've got it on their books. Guaranteed annuity options, with profits products are a huge staple of the liabilities on their books. And essentially what you can imagine for a company that is essentially in the market of aggregating closed books, their business model is all about driving efficiency, driving where the profit's going to come from. They're not really going to come from the selling of new policies. So it's all about operational efficiency. How do they drive efficiency in that business to generate the returns on the business? So over the last couple of years, as Solvency II has really come into play, they've instituted a couple of massive projects, one of which is a Solvency II project. And alongside that and somewhat overlapping with it is a complete actuarial systems transformation project. The reason they've undertaken that, Solvency II has been somewhat of a catalyst, but not the sole catalyst. Essentially, that type of business, as it buys up these blocks of business, it ports over the systems, infrastructure, people, processes along with it. So they've essentially got one of the most complicated businesses from an operational perspective around. So literally to do evaluation or some risk or some capital analysis, it takes them months on end to sort through, or has taken months on end to sort through all the different actuarial models to be able to produce that information. So that has massive influence or consequences for risk management, for capital management, and just the production of the information that needs to feed that. So they embarked on a massive actuarial systems transformation program to basically replace their hundreds of models with one unique platform. That platform was the Milliman MG Alpha platform, and alongside of that, They also implemented a daily solvency monitoring platform, which enabled them to not just do their actual evaluations, but to essentially overlay risk and capital management information on a daily basis. So that's what I'm going to be talking to you today about. Interestingly, the program itself, just the AST part of it, was the largest ever project that Milliman in its 60-year history undertook. Ranged in the tens of millions of pounds, multiple tens of millions of pounds budget, and involved up to about 30 consultants on site for a number of years at their offices in the UK. So as part of that, I was my role in particular was the lead systems designer for the daily solvency monitoring component, which I want to talk to you in a bit more detail today. So looking at the key project drivers, really, and this kind of applies fairly broadly across both AST and DSM, essentially the main one was to reduce operational cost. You know, the large bulk of the costs in the company are relating to the production of MI, which relate to the actuarial team. So really it's a question of how do you get them operating more efficiently on less people doing, you know, what they're really designed to do, which is perform analytics as opposed to actual, you know, pushing data and the like around. So a large part of that also was due to the company's desire to put in place an internal model in order to get that Solvency II compliant that essentially has to pass the use test. And that basically means that any risk or capital model that they want to use to produce a capital number, they have to be able to demonstrate that they use that in their risk management processes within the company. Another massive driver of the project was to reduce the operational risk capital that they're holding on the balance sheet. You can imagine a company like that with a myriad of processes and systems has huge amounts of complexity just to the operations for which they have to have huge amounts of op-risk capital to support that. Another key aspect of their business is, or another key driver of the project was, for this type of business, when they're bringing on new blocks of business, they want to be able to do that at low marginal cost. You know, you don't want to have to operate under a traditional model where you're just bolting on multiple heterogeneous blocks of businesses. You want to be able to just integrate straight into the one platform. And essentially, that gives you a competitive advantage when you're pricing new blocks of business. And, of course, there was huge amounts of pressure from management, shareholders and the board to get better quality of information faster in order to be able to make better risk and strategic capital management decisions. So in terms of a very, very high-level use of DSM, it wasn't a formal requirement for, or a component of DSM was used or is used for Solvency II regulatory reporting, although that wasn't the formal reporting mechanism. Similarly, on the ICA, under the UK's existing capital reporting standard, it's essentially used to calculate capital under that basis. I think a key reason for the business's adoption of this type of framework is because they're exposed to a huge range of risk drivers, and that has increased as new blocks of business have come on. Literally, as I said before, they've got every product that's ever been written in the UK over the last 30 years, so they've got huge amounts of exposure to a lot of market-based risk drivers. So trying to get a sense of what their exposure is as opposed to just a broad category, this is equity, this is rate risk, this is FX risk. You want to be able to drill into that in a lot more detail to get a better handle on it. Critically for this type of business, the amount of capital they hold is going to be fundamental to driving returns in the business. So optimising that capital, operating at lower thresholds over the standard solvency capital requirement was absolutely key. And a key part of that also was in terms of the risk management strategies they bring to the business. That's going to be essential for them to be able to control the risks on their balance sheet. And then finally, real-time active risk management is really a goal of where a lot of insurance companies are trying to get to. Some have implemented it for some blocks of business, and there's a different spectrum out there in many different markets. And Phoenix's goal was really to leave them much more up to that end of the risk management spectrum. So the next few slides, I'll give you a very high-level perspective on some of the core output that the company was really driving at. This is one example of essentially you can think of the core suite of output as constituting a base balance sheet and a stress balance sheet. And that stress balance sheet can be undertaken, under a range of different bases depending upon what the metric is that you're looking at. So it can be Pillar 1, Pillar 2, and here these are the Solvency 2 categories, which are broadly similar to our domestic categories, as well as risk-based stresses. So we're primarily looking at capital-based stresses and risk-based stresses. Now, that information would then kind of needs to feed through into some form of capital aggregator, and that would need to be bespoke depending upon what type of capital calculation is, which would then feed into various reporting templates on solvency, capital, and risk, essentially. Now, importantly, that type of information needed to be produced at all different levels of the corporate structure. So for this type of company, as would be the case for some of the larger domestic players in our market, we want to understand what those metrics are at a group level, a subgroup level, a company, a fund level, and potentially at a much more detailed kind of liability pool level, which you can essentially think of as a product-based level. So when you do that and you're looking across that dimension, you're starting to look at huge quantities of output information. So this is almost at the highest level summary of information that we're trying to produce, producing available capital broken down into the balance sheet components on the assets and liability side, and then within each of those categories, breaking it down by asset type and by liability type, essentially. On the required side, the required capital side, producing obviously the basic capital metrics, and then distilling those down into the risk categories. So understanding what the capital coverage ratios are and what the underlying drivers are into that. Now, as I said, that needs to be performed on an individual fund level as well as an overall group level, company level, etc. On the market risk side, we're trying to understand what essentially the Greeks are of the company. So these are the numbers that go into a risk management process to be able to facilitate dynamic hedging as opposed to traditional static hedging. I'm not going to take you through all of those, but it's essentially looking at breaking down liabilities and assets and comparing them to threshold by kind of risk category at a relatively detailed level. So underneath each one of those kind of broad categories, equities, FX, rates, etc., would be kind of the next level of detail on the specific risk driver. So essentially, on a daily basis, we're producing validation reports in addition to those reports around market data, what's been run, a market-based monitoring one. And then on a quarterly basis, we're producing calibration results and performance on the replicating portfolios. So this is important because on a quarterly basis, there's essentially a formal run of, well, a run of the formal truth model, which was or is MG Alpha, which essentially that information gets used to seed the core balance sheet. And so what needs to be done at a more granular daily basis is you can't necessarily run that full system, which is full stochastic across the entire block of business, because that run is quite expensive to do. So essentially we're trying to replicate a lot of liabilities to remove that stochastic element, to bring it down to deterministic runs, so that we can essentially reproduce the balance sheet with a high degree of accuracy on a short-term basis. So when we're designing the system, there's a number of different things that needed to be considered, and particularly for Phoenix's kind of objectives around reducing resource level and making the resource level to support those calculations a lot less skilled or sophisticated, because it's essentially process-orientated work. development versus maintenance cost. The company traditionally had undertaken and produced a lot of numbers internally. They wanted to move to an external maintenance-based driven model, which meant the system and the service provision was external to the company. Flexibility, robustness versus control, and data quality versus availability are key dimensions across which would influence the exact nature of the process or the data transfer process or the use of the system. And then finally, and certainly not leastly, the use of internal technology versus external technology. Phoenix made the bold decision to essentially use the Microsoft Azure grid cloud computing infrastructure and solution, which Milliman as a whole kind of partnered with Microsoft to bundle in and make MG Alpha and our DSM solution an integral part of the Azure platform. So essentially it gives them the ability to run processes, to run calculation processes on almost an infinitely scalable bank of computers. So as opposed to, you know, we've been using in-house grid computing technology with, you know, hundreds of nodes for quite a while now. But literally for this company, we tested and scaled up to 10,000 nodes on the cloud, and it ran perfectly. So the use of that type of technological platform enables you to get a huge amount of computations done in short time periods. So this type of project, I think, involved a number of different paradigm shifts relative to where I think traditional actuarial processes are. The first is it needs to be enterprise scale. We're talking about the full company here, the full balance sheet, all assets, all liabilities on multiple different bases. That calculation has to be accurate so it can support risk management decisions. It has to be quick. So that kind of comes back to my previous point that they wanted to use or needed to move to a cloud-based solution. Even for this type of business, they had over 150,000 individual assets. And when we replicated the liabilities, they were running into millions of individual RP assets. It also needed to be relatively, or fully in the case of the daily solvency monitoring component, automated. And that presented quite a significant challenge because we're trying to get this to operate and run on a marginally minimal cost basis. So if I can talk just briefly about the systems perspective, essentially a user would come in, and I think this is representative of the way actuarial processes are going to be run in the future. They're going to be web-based. You'll kind of interact with a primary web UI screen. You'll essentially have control over your models. In the Phoenix case, those models were completely locked down. And that was both for the core truth model of MG Alpha as well as DSM. You interact with a workspace, and essentially what you're doing is you're binding data sets to calculation models, and you're then saying, bind those two things together, send that off into the grid, I want those results, and then that information gets pumped back into an internal database on the right-hand side from which reporting services, and there's a number of very good reporting services on various grids that are available now from Microsoft and Amazon and so forth. That whole process, from a daily perspective, is automated. There is, from a quarterly perspective, it is essentially a user. There is a user intervention that's required, but it's a relatively simple kind of binding of data to model calculations. So, in terms of the daily process, we're looking at kind of a process that runs from early evening, comes 6 or 7 o'clock, that's a cut-off point. You then essentially go out and extract your data from your various data sources through FTP feeds. You would then kick off a valuation process at, say, 8 o'clock. And then the very next day, you essentially want that valuation process to be finished by 6 a.m. or thereabouts to give you a couple of hours for producing your reports and validating those reports. So the interesting part is in this valuation component, because you've essentially got a 10-hour time window here, and if you've got, you know, a few thousand hours of processing time that you need to do, how are you going to undertake that? And You can do it internally with a grid, but if you're going to do that, you need to support all the infrastructure and the systems that go along with that. So an outsource-based solution here is absolutely fundamental, and that's why the company ran with Microsoft Azure cloud-based solution, which we supported that solution. So the key outcome of that is that it shifts the balance of work that the actuaries in the company are doing from much less process-orientated work to really focusing on the analytics and the decision-making processes that MI produces or supports. In terms of the risk factor coverage, I'll skip through the next few slides in fairly high level in the interest of time. From the dimension of the coverage of the risk-based factors, from a daily perspective, what you really want to know about are the market-based risk factors. Your demographics and your behavioural factors don't really change on a daily basis, but you're really interested in understanding how your balance sheet is responding to changes in rates, markets, vols, etc., etc. So we had essentially a daily process for updating all this information, which is essentially capital market information. On the asset valuation side, again, the standard was we wanted asset valuations that were accurate enough to be able to trade off those asset valuations. So that meant implementing market-based standard code for some asset classes and our own internal proprietary code for some of the more complex asset classes. But essentially, the asset-based tools that we use are those that we use to support our other hedging clients from which we manage very large hedge portfolios for. On the liability side, there's a key step here. The key question is, how do you synthesise a complex liability into a deterministic replicated asset? That is a non-trivial exercise which there is required quite a large amount of expertise. I did a presentation last year at the biennial convention drilling into this in a bit more detail. So you could get a hold of that presentation, which goes into this in a fair bit of detail. But essentially, the tools and methods that we use primarily related to asset backing, option identification, and the parametric function methodologies, which are all about trying to understand what the nature of the underlying guarantee is that's been offered to the customer, and you try and find a matching asset. By matching, I put that in inverted commas, you can never get it perfect, but you want to try and get it as close enough as you can. And then that gives you the ability to essentially value these things deterministically. The downside is that it means you need to do it at a seriatim per policy level. So if you've got 6 million policies and you're trying to replicate, or even if you've got a couple of hundred thousand policies and you're trying to replicate that balance sheet, and that balance sheet's got half a dozen items on it, that each one requires a separate replication strategy, then the numbers of replicating assets can get very large very quickly. Next few slides just give you a few high-level illustrations of some of the results. So these actually are actual results without being specific to the block. So here, this is just the base balance sheet of the MG Alpha. You can consider that the truth model in the green, and the black is the replicating portfolio approach. So it's fairly straightforward to replicate the base valuation. So that's really just a calibration issue. The key test comes in when you stress it. And so here we're looking at the various capital market and capital level type stresses, so very extreme stresses, 30-40% down down shocks on the equity markets. So we're getting very, very good results. Different dimension, just looking at the differences in terms of a ratio or a raw difference. These types of results are sufficient for us to essentially be able to produce a balance sheet, to roll forward a balance sheet, and to calculate a stress balance sheet on a daily basis for a relatively short period of time. And in this case, it was around about we had a quarterly process for the truth model. And after that point, you would essentially recalibrate your replicating portfolios back to essentially the truth model. So you don't want to leave this for too long, because as you go along and various things move, capital markets move, those second order cross creek effects start to become a bit more material, and your replication fit kind of starts to wane a little bit. So you want to recalibrate every now and again, and you want to keep tabs on or have a sense of what type of market conditions are going to break that calibration point, in which case you would then need to call for a rerun of the base liability valuation model. So I'll finish off with my final slide. The project itself was a huge project, both for Milne and for the company. It involved huge amounts of resources on both sides, and there was a number of factors which went into determining whether it was a success. On the technical side, clearly there was huge technical challenges. We faced huge technical challenges if we're trying to replicate their liabilities. But the good thing is actuaries tend to be really good at solving technical challenges. Technical challenges have technical problems to them. And we pretty much got through all of them. Management actions, tail dependencies, non-market risks, they're all challenges that essentially have solutions. And I think the bigger issues are on kind of the delivery side, so the project management side. We had some challenges around defining very specifically what the requirements were. Everyone knew kind of generally what we were trying to do, but because it was almost a transformational type of project that involved valuation, risk, capital, everyone had a different perspective on the detail to which they wanted, and kind of getting a consensus on those requirements was a fair challenge. Data accessibility is always an issue, and relating to the first point, keeping to scope, as people wanted to kind of push out the boundaries of the level of detail that needed to be covered, keeping to scope was certainly a challenge. Stakeholder engagement is always something that is fundamental to any project. Given the length of the project over 18 months, two-year period, keeping those stakeholders engaged was certainly a big part of what drove the success of the project. On the technicals, and maybe this should be in the technical side, the acceptance criterion tolerances around the replication was something of an issue. It's no good having your tolerance threshold set at a really, really minimal level, because you're just going to break it all the time and it's not going to be that material. So where you set that bar is actually quite an interesting question. And then finally, managing the dependence with MG Alpha. As I said, the DSM project was very much a sub-project within the overall actuarial systems transformation, and it certainly was a challenge to manage the implementation of that when your reference point itself is actually moving, because they're trying to reconcile to previous models. So my recommendation for anyone kind of wanting to move down this path is don't do those things at the same time if you can avoid it. Try and stage them so you've got a firm base before you start to move into a replication world.
Josh, we might leave that slide up because that might be a fruitful place for questions from the floor.
Sure.
Thank you, Josh, for that presentation. Do you want to take questions from there or sit down?
You'll happy
stay
standing.
Up there. It's over to the people in the audience now. There's a microphone up the front. If you'd like to make a question or a comment, please stand and state your name for the record, and we'll see how we go in the remaining 15 minutes or so. So who's first? Questions?
Thanks, Joshua. I'm Trang Duncanson from Deloitte. I was interested in your perspective, because this is Pillar 1 on Solvency 2, which is highly complex out in Europe and UK. So we wouldn't expect that level of complexity here in Australia at all. So I was interested in this presentation, which aspects of it could Australian insurers and banks actually take away in terms of lessons?
Well, you're absolutely right in the sense that Pillar 1 here is a diluted version of Pillar 1 in Solvency 2. It's not true that the project scope was just Pillar 1. It was very much Pillar 1, Pillar 2, so the ORSA, an internal model basis as well. So that kind of comes back to my previous slide around, the huge amount of scope of doing these calculations. I think the main the main lesson is that the primary driver isn't necessarily regulatory compliance. The primary driver is, I think, if I had to say, the primary driver is getting better information to support risk management and essentially capital management decisions. So that's a huge issue, particularly for this type of company where they've got huge amounts of market-based risks and various risk drivers. And I think as companies in our market here essentially take more risk on with the introduction of new products, because the risk in the business in insurance companies' business has over the last 10 or so years has been relatively straightforward. But as that risk starts to come back on the books, there's certainly going to be a demand for better management information, higher quality, more frequent information around understanding what those risk drivers are and understanding how they can be mitigated. And the capital frameworks are a very good framework to operate within to understand that.
Next question.
Thanks, Joshua. Alan Ng. Two questions, if I may. First is about the regulator, so FSA. What are their thoughts on this exercise? And in particular, given that now Phoenix has access to daily solvency, did the regulator say, hey, I'll actually wouldn't mind looking at that on a daily basis? So that's the first question. Second question is actually more about the cost-benefit. Given the company spent multi-tens of millions of pounds, as you said, now, certainly, I assume the more concrete benefit is coming through from a capital benefit where they can demonstrate to the regulator and say, given that, and from the operational side as well, they can therefore hold less capital. Kind of over how long a time frame would it take for them to actually recoup the actual fiscal cost? I mean, I know there's intangible benefits of just general better risk management, but from a tangible economic benefit perspective, what kind of time frame are we looking at? Thank you.
If I can just back up a little bit. So Solvency II compliance has been pushed back, or got pushed back a year. So they haven't got to the point where they've gone through the internal model sign-off process with the FSA. So the FSA would essentially be very, very happy, as it's put out a number of different publications and statements saying risk management is very, very high on its priority list, and it's really encouraging people to utilise approaches, systems, tools, techniques to better understand risk and better manage it. And it's certainly facilitating that through giving companies sign off on compliance with their internal models. So it's certainly in the process of going to that, but it's not there quite yet. And then on your second question around the tangible cost-benefit analysis. So there's clearly a lot of benefit in this type of approach. Just to come back to my previous point around the size of the projects being tens of millions, that was for the entire actuarial systems transformation project. So the daily solvency monitoring component of that was the minority component of that. So the value proposition can be seen from both perspectives. And really the outcome in terms of the huge reduction in operational risk capital, which was itself in kind of orders of magnitude of that tens of millions of pounds, certainly has come through due to the implementation of that entire AST type of program, of which we were a component, or the DSM project was a component. Following on from that, that cost saving was relatively immediate, but the longer term benefit is in a reduction in overall cost to just run the business, essentially. So one of the key lessons, I think, coming out of this from an actuarial perspective is if you're managing a team of actuaries, and you've got a large number of actuaries that are doing work that's largely process-orientated, which could otherwise be replicated through systems, much more effective use of systems, you can essentially scale back that team very, very significantly, or you can redirect them into much more higher level types of tasks. Phoenix are going to do essentially both. So there will be a reduction in that team, the quantity of that team, and a redirection of their work, essentially. And those cost savings will obviously take a while to come through as people get more comfort with the analytics, and changing people in a massive way is relatively slow process. But you're probably talking in a 3 to 5 year type of time frame before you really see kind of the full scale benefits on the cost saving side. And that's not to say that the company is not getting benefit on the DSM side, because they are. It's giving them a huge uplift in their capability to produce risk and capital information much more quickly. And so the benefits of that is that they can move to better hedging strategies. They can move away from static-based hedging strategies to more dynamic-based strategies, which are more efficient. And that, the saving there is a little bit more intangible in the sense that, it comes down to how much money is that strategy saving you relative to the strategy you would have otherwise been forced to take, which is more static and lagging with respect to what the markets are doing.
Owen?
Thanks, Bernard. Thanks, Josh. Owen Wormald from Zurich. Really, really interesting presentation. Can you give us a little bit of a context, and it might well be following on from the previous question, about where this fits into what the industry generally is up to there, and by implication, what Australia might. For example, the appetite for this. Was this a first, or were they catching up, or, I'm really focusing on the daily solvency measurement aspect of things. It seems to me the difference between daily, weekly, monthly monitoring at a detailed level using drivers. There's all sorts of different ways that you could do it, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question, and there's multiple different dimensions to it. So if I don't cover off on the right one, then feel free to come up to me afterwards. There was very much a case that because of the nature of the business, they were probably on the lagging end of their operational process capability, both from a systems and just a process complexity perspective. So this is really designed to try and take them from being essentially behind the pack to not just where kind of the other tier one insurance companies in the UK are, but actually take them well beyond that. If you think of other actuarial systems out there, and I'm not talking about any specific one here, they're largely operating in the old environment of desktop type software with an element of some grid computing capability or some parallel processing capability. This is the architecture that the company went down was kind of the natural evolutionary step beyond that. And so that facilitated a huge transformation in their operational structure and the cost savings that come along with that. So, we as a firm actually invested hugely in our own technology and capability in our platforms to facilitate that, to the point where we think they're out there beyond the defining the leading edge of the UK market at the moment. So is that kind of covering the dimension you wanted me to cover, or are you talking more about from a risk management perspective?
Well, how transferable the experience might be to
From an Australian context, I think that would still be the case. I think it would still be more advanced than what we have seen here locally. From a risk management perspective, I think they're still in the process of catching up. It's one thing to produce huge amounts of information. It's another thing to know exactly how to use it and to feed it into to the risk management process. And that just takes time to synthesise. So from that perspective, I think they're perhaps still catching up to both UK companies, US companies, and some Australian companies.
Probably got time for one last question. Duncan? Sorry, David. You might get a quick one if Duncan is very quick.
Duncan Rawlinson, a couple of quick questions, please. I've lost track of how many businesses they've swallowed up now in the UK, but can you just give us a bit of a sense of their total liabilities, how much of what proportion is with profits, GAOs, and the like? I mean, how much of this is, you mentioned market risk, but how much of this is actually liabilities that have a very substantial asset liability mismatch that they're managing?
A huge amount. In terms of their size of the overall closed blocks, I think they're something around 40% of the market.
But of their business, most of it's with profits, is it?
Yeah, that's correct. The majority of it is with profits. So the majority of it has huge amounts of embedded guarantees in it.
So if I understand the model correctly then, they're managing their business and risk managing their business and running their hedging process is dependent on the operation of the cloud. Is that right? Because you said they're running this overnight through the cloud to get their, to get whatever their sort of trading sheets are the next day to run their hedging program.
Correct.
Which is integral then to their management of solvency around a thinner capital base than they would otherwise have.
Correct.
What's the regulator's attitude to the op risk associated with the cloud then for this business?
Yeah, there's a number of dimensions to that answer. It's certainly on the positive side relative to their existing operational capability and complexity. So that's the first thing. You know, you're coming from a world that's just horrendously complex to something that's much, much simpler. The interesting thing with that is they are now highly dependent upon one or two key service operators, us being one and Microsoft being another. So, you know, it's certainly not without risk. There's certainly risk there. And as for the regulators' perspectives on that, I don't personally know. I haven't got to that level of knowledge, unfortunately. But I would imagine they would be broadly positive, because this is a direction that we as a firm have taken. And to be honest, I would be very surprised if some of the other actuarial systems vendors out there don't eventually get to as well.
Yes, David Rush. I'm the spy from APRA, the Australian regulator. Following on from Duncan's question, I suppose, because you mentioned frequently the use of cloud technology, and that seems to be an advantage from your perspective. But I'm aware that cloud is a little bit of a dirty word in the regulator, basically because there are concerns that data security is not quite so so strong with cloud technology. How have you managed to square those two?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually. Essentially, in the EU, we have data protection laws in this country, and the EU have exactly the same, that operate across the entire EU framework. And data security is a very, very important component. If you actually look at Microsoft's implementation of their data centres, they literally have two in the US, they have two in Europe, in Dublin and Amsterdam, and they have two in Asia. So essentially, Phoenix are restricted to using those two data centres that sit within the EU from a data protection perspective. And so we're essentially using one of them as the primary data centre, and the other one as essentially a backup data centre. So none of the data actually leaves EU and the EU legislative environment, essentially. But you would absolutely have that issue if they were using the US data centres or the Asian data centres. And I can imagine it potentially could be an issue if you're operating outside any of those other countries that use it.
Thanks, Josh. Thank you to everyone on the floor that asked questions and for all of you that listened. There is a feedback form. Fill it in, or if you're on the web, you can fill in the web app. And I'd like you to thank Josh in the usual manner.